like I said, what I decided to do, rather than, because we didn't have the time to go through the whole Megillah, so what I decided to do was take one topic and try and, you know, take the one more shear that we have and do what we can to address that topic as it runs through the, you know, through a close reading of the text in the Megillah. So the topic that I chose was Esther's character. That is the way in which we are introduced to Esther in the Megillah and how that character develops, because I think it's actually, literarily speaking, one of the more interesting characters in Tanakh. When we first meet Esther, she's extremely passive. She's somebody who everything is basically done for her or to her, and she doesn't really have much of an active role at all. Eventually, that turns a complete 180, and Esther becomes the most dominant and most active character in the story, to the point that she's the one who's pulling the strings and she's the one who's doing everything. As by way of introduction, so the first two sources I think are actually just reflective. Again, this is looking back retrospectively on how the development of Esther takes place. So we could just see it from that prism. Source number one is actually something that I mentioned in both during the shir yesterday afternoon and the Chal Shudis when I was speaking. But very, very important psukim, perhaps the most important psukim in the entire Megillah, because they are about the establishment of Purim. They are about the establishment of Megillat Esther and what aspects of the story of Purim were being highlighted when Mordechai and Esther were looking to establish the holiday. So if you're looking at source number one, the beginning of the source, the beginning from Pasuk Chaf to Chaf Dalet, it's about through Chaf Gimel, it's about Mordechai writing down this whole royal edict, sending it out to all of the Jewish inhabitants, the Jewish residents of the Persian Empire. And then when we get to Pasuk Chaf Dalet is the recap. It's the summary of the story that was basically the justification for the holiday being established. So look at Chaf Dalet. Ki Haman ben Hamadata ha'agagi. Right, and the reason that I'm pointing this out is because look at we all know the story. The story is something that we've been learning since we were children. We know that the previous eight prakim of Megillat Esther tell the story from Ahasuerus' party to Vashti to Esther's selection to Haman's frustration with Mordechai to the royal edict to Mordechai's reaction to the debate between Esther and Mordechai to Esther's beseeching of the king to the parties to Kachia Selaish to taking Mordechai through the city. So we all know the whole story. Look at Pasuk Chaf Dalet about what aspects of the story are being emphasized in the recap of what Chag Purim is supposed to be about. So Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Ki Haman ben Hamadata ha'agagi tzorer kol ha'yudim chashav al ha'yudim la'abdam. This guy, Haman, right, Haman, who was the nemesis of the Jewish people, Haman, chashav al ha'yudim la'abdam, he requested, he desired, he planned to destroy all of the Jewish people. V'hipil pur, right, so far the only thing that we know about is that Haman conspired against the existence of the Jewish people. V'hipil pur hu agoral hu mamu la'abdam. And how did he go about trying to destroy them? By casting this lot, right, by having this lottery of the poor. Pasuk Chaf Hei. Alright, again, so the only thing that we know so far about the story, we don't know anything about Mordechai, we don't know anything about Esther, we don't know anything about the plans, or the only thing we know is the plan and the lot that was cast in order to enact that plan. Chaf Hei. Uvevoa lifnei ha-melech, when Esther, alright, just referring to Esther, uvevoa lifnei ha-melech, when Esther came before the king, Amarim ha-sefer yashuv ma-chashavto ha-ra'a she-chashav al ha-yudim al-rosho. And what happened? So Haman conspired, he cast this lot, and then Esther came before the king and requested that it be taken away. And as a result, what happened? Haman and his sons were hanged on a tree. So this is a little bit of a misleading summary of what the story actually is. I imagine, right, we can all think of aspects of the narrative that we read in the first eight prekim of Megillat Esther that are being skipped over. Mordechai's name is not even mentioned. Esther, it doesn't even mention Esther's plan. Esther's, what's it called? her gathering of the people for 3 days. Go and gather everybody together. Esther's efforts, Esther's conspiratorial planning, all of that is skipped over, and the only thing that we have is when she went before the king and made the request, the king granted it and hanged Haman and his sons. So there are reasons why we can say this was highlighted and what wasn't highlighted. But what I want to emphasize, at least for the purposes of our discussion this morning, is that who are the characters that are mentioned in this recap of the story? Three of them. Who are they?
Haman,
the Melech, and Esther. Zehu. Mordechai is not mentioned at all. None of the Vashti is not mentioned at all. None of the other people. So we have the protagonist, the antagonist, and definitely have the antagonist. Then we have the king, and we have Esther. Now that is extremely significant when you take a look a little bit further on. When you take a look from the beginning of the Megillah and you see how the Megillah is presenting Esther altogether. Before we start though, I want to just emphasize this point not only from the text itself but from Chazal. So Chazal, we actually read part of this Gemara last time we were talking. So the Chazal present Esther as having a discussion with the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah about the establishment not only of the holiday of Purim, but also of the bringing of Megillat Esther into the canon of Tanakh. Right, and I didn't even quote the discussion. I just wanted to emphasize the fact that Esther is here. Source number two: Amar Rabbi Yehuda Bar Yehuda. Shalach alehem Esther lachachamim, kavuni l'dorot. Establish me for all generations, for posterity. And then a few lines later, Shalach alehem Esther lachachamim, kitvuni l'dorot. Establish my book for posterity. So the discussion, the way Chazal, all right, and again, this is going to be that much more interesting when we start to take a look at Esther herself and how she's presented, at least at the beginning of the story. When Chazal are discussing Esther, Purim's establishment, and Megillat Esther's entrance into the canon of Tanakh, it's done through the lens of Esther. Not Mordechai, not Achashverosh, the person with whom we associate the holiday is Esther. It's known as Megillat Esther. Not Megillat Mordechai, not Megillat Achashverosh, it's Megillat Esther. Esther is the dominant figure. Now, When you look at the story, the question that we're going to need to ask ourselves is to what extent that is an appropriate characterization. Who are the other potential candidates, for the dominant figure? Who?
Mordechai and Haman.
So Mordechai could be, right? Haman would be the evil antagonist, but he probably is a central figure. And Achashverosh, I think, would probably be the only other. Example. I would argue that the more fitting character in terms of who's pulling the strings and who's behind the scenes and who the story is being driven, and there's a bunch of different ways that we can prove this from, would be Mordechai. Because, and that's not because Esther doesn't play a dominant role, it's because Esther doesn't play a dominant role the entire time. Right? The closing of Megillat Esther is what? The last pasuk that we read out loud. How does it read? Let me bali kriya amongst us. Right? What's the? I don't even have it here. What's the last pasuk? Ki Mordechai Yehudi Mishnel Hamelech Achashverosh. Right? Right? Shmo Olech VeGadol Ratzoy LeRov Echav VeDever Shalom Mechol. Right? So the closing lines of the Megillah are about Mordechai. The first time that we're introduced to the character. There are people out there for lots of different reasons. We're not going to discuss whether they're good or bad. There are lots of people out there that add a minhag to Esther that had never existed before, and that's when we are introduced to Esther. We basically stop and repeat a pasuk as well. So the main reason why people do that, why I think that is silly, is because there is no natural place to do that. The text itself doesn't introduce Esther the way it introduces Mordechai, and we'll see in a second, because that's what we're actually going to look at these pasukim. The text introduces Mordechai as the dominant figure. The minhag to stop and have everybody recite that pasuk, right? Ish Yehudiah Yab Shoshana Birah Shmo Mordechai. That, think about it literally. The narrative stopping and saying the words Ish Yehudiah Yab Shoshana Birah is an introducing of a main character. The fact that we haven't mentioned him yet, and now suddenly we are. All right, all of this I'm telling you, I'm just mentioning, because I think it's interesting that this is known as Megillat Esther. I think it's interesting that it's Ashal Chaluhum Esther Lefachamim Kavuni Ladorot. That Esther eventually becomes not only a dominant figure, but the dominant figure of the story is particularly interesting when you look at it within the wider context of how the Megillah unfolds, how the characters are presented. Okay, everybody with me? Any questions? Okay, so let's jump right into the text. And we're going to take a look with this theme in mind. We're going to look at how Esther is presented. Okay, and the best way to do it is basically to talk about how somebody else is emphasized, like I was just saying. So, source number three. Keep in mind we're about five psukim into Perek Bet. So, Perek Aleph starts with Achashverosh's parties, the event with Vashti, and how Vashti eventually was killed because of the plan of that Mumuchan was presented. That's what we are actually discussing last time. Now we stop the story. Stuma, actually, when you open up a Megillah, we actually have a Megillah here if anybody wants to look afterwards. So, and there's a Stuma, and then we have this new character being introduced. Ishu di haya b'Shushan Avira. There's this guy who lived in Shushan. Ushmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish Ishimini. Who was he? This is the son of Yair, the son of Shimi, the Sheman Kish, Ishimini. Asher Haglav Yerushalayim, Imagola, Asher Haglata, Imichanya Melech Yehuda. Going back to the Zionism Shiurim, when we were actually discussing the history of Galut Babel, so Yechanya, or Yechonyahu, he was one of the last of Malchei Yehuda, and he was actually exiled, and that didn't spell the Churban Beit HaMikdash. He was actually exiled, and then a new king was installed in his place, but with him, he was exiled with thousands of the Jews to Babel. So this was already three generations since the truth is it really depends on how you read this pasuk. Asher Haglam Yerushalayim is not clear who it's referring to. So it could be that it's referring to Mordechai, which is, I think, classically how it's understood. But if you look at the generationally, and if you look at the history of how long they were in Babylon, and what period of history this was happening, it actually is a more plausible read to say that either Yair, Shimi, or Kish were the one that was exiled. In which case, Mordechai is either a second or third generation exile. So he's somebody that's right. He's the grandchild of the last person that lived in the Altarheim. And if that's the case, then I think we can appreciate another aspect of the Megillah that's being introduced to us. Now, for the first time, all right, if we're going to understand it that way, we can really see that the Megillah is a story not only about Jewish oppression, but it's Jewish oppression and a Jewish people that is being selected for their difference amongst an assimilated populace. This is a third generation from the Galut Babel. It's three generations then that Bnei Yisrael, that Bnei Yehuda, have had the opportunity to assimilate into the culture around them. And if you're looking for evidence of this, the name Mordechai is, I mentioned this last time, the name Mordechai is 100% unquestionably Persian. And we have, I've read an article about this. We have countless examples of this name at that contemporaneously actually being used. It was a Persian name. It was called Marduk. All right, Marduk, which was Mordechai, it actually is, if I remember, I read this ages ago. I think it might be a reference to a Persian deity. And if that's the case, so Mordechai not only had an assimilated name, it would be the equivalent of somebody here being named Christopher. All right, it would be the kid in Shul whose name is Christopher. It's not just a Goyish name, right? To use the colloquialism. It's not just a Goyish name, it's a name that is actually invoking a foreign deity. So you can think, if you want to appreciate the text from that perspective, we're talking about not only a couple of generations removed from the Alter Heim, but we're talking about an assimilation story that's going on. And I think, I mean, and it, this has, I imagine this has particular resonance for us in the Jews of the 20th century, and we can appreciate how things have unfolded in the last 60, 70 years. We can appreciate you know, what it's like for a Jewish community to be in a foreign land, right, to be in this, and to begin to assimilate, and how over generations that takes on new characterizations and new forms. And now all of a sudden somebody starts singling the Jews out when they've been doing nothing but integrating and reintegrating into their surrounding culture. How that can really play such a potent role. Now, if you think about it, if you're going to think, again, this is not our topic. Our topic is Esther. But if you are thinking about this from this perspective, some of the psukim that don't get enough attention in the Megillah are the reaction of the people, or at least the reaction of the people that is being referenced. When Mordechai, when the decree goes out, and it says that Yirshoshan Navocha. So, what is that referring to? All right? If you're talking about, by the way, Navocha is not a word that's used too much in Tanakh. So, if we think about it from the perspective of an assimilated people who are living in a foreign land, who, you know, in every respect are, you know, hooked up in society. Mordechai was an important guy. He was living in the Persian court. He was definitely well connected. We can assume that wasn't so rare, right? But nobody cared that Mordechai was a Jew until Haman started making a stink about it. It seems, at least the way the Megillah presents it, it seems that Mordechai's place in the Persian court was perfectly normal. Okay, now if we can take assumptions based on this, then the narrative, the portrayal that was being presented here in the Megillah is that it's perfectly normal for the Jewish people to be in this situation. Now imagine in that Rahmana Litzlan, it was such a situation where if in America, where we have Jews in every level of government and in every level of industry. Right? I mean, it's not that foreign. Think about what it was like in Germany in the 30s. And then a Pashkavil goes up on the wall saying that all Jews are slated for death. Right? That's Navocha. Yeah.
And yet, Mordechai told us to don't reveal your background, so what's that about?
It's a good question. So since our topic is Esther, and I'm getting far off here, but since our topic is Esther, I want to discuss that. But the point that I'm trying to emphasize here is just to appreciate the context. All right, the first thing that we're told about Mordechai is his lineage, and if you understand his name, then we know that he actually was, at least his name was assimilated. So appreciate, right, and recognize what's going on within the context of the story and how it's being set up. Okay, let's go on. All right, now we're finally meeting Esther in Pasuk Zayin. Vayhi omein et hadasa, hi Esther bat dodo, ki in la avaim. Right, and he raised, and he was taking care of this woman named Hadassah, who was Esther, who was the bat dodo. So that means that she was what to him?
Niece.
Right, it was his bat dodo. So it was the daughter of his uncle. Right, so does that mean that it's his niece?
No.
So this, strictly speaking, all right, how the way we would translate this is that she was the daughter of his uncle, which would mean that she was his cousin. Okay. So who was his dodo? So presumably, Mordechai's father was Yair, so Yair had a brother whom we don't know, who is just somebody we would know him as Yair's brother. And Yair's brother, he for whatever reason wasn't around, and Esther was being raised by her cousin. That's again the we usually understand it to be her uncle. The strict reading of the psukim was that she was his cousin. Okay, because she didn't have a father or mother. Rahat Nara, and what's the first thing that we are told about Esther, other than the fact that she was an orphan and was being raised by her cousin Mordechai? Rahat Nara, Yifat Torah v'Tovat Mareh. She was a beautiful woman. Uvemot Aviyah v'Ima l'kacha Mordechai lo levat. And when her parents died, Mordechai came along and took her as his own daughter. Okay, so the first thing that we are told about Esther, right, and it's actually repeated. Right, this pasuk is repeating things. Right, he took care of Esther. And then you should just know that she was very beautiful, and you should know that Mordechai took her as his own daughter. So the fact that Mordechai was taking care of her is repeated twice. Am I wrong? Right, couldn't we have just stopped at Vahanarayi Fatorah Vatavatnareh and end the pasuk there? And then we would know everything that we would need to know about Esther. The fact that we are repeating the Mordechai being taken care of her is—it seems like it's superfluous. So, what do you think that's going to be telling us about it? The fact that we know two things about Esther: Her parents are dead, and Mordechai is taking care of her, and or maybe three things. Her parents are dead, Mordechai is taking care of her as a result, and she's very beautiful. Two of those three things are repeated.
And he's taking care of her again.
Yeah. Second. So two of those three things. That her parents are dead, or Mordechai is taking care of her as a result, and she's very beautiful. So two of those three things are repeated twice in the one pasuk that introduces Esther. So I would argue that what the pasuk is doing here is setting us up with the most important thing, or at least initially, what is going to be the most important thing that we need to know about Esther. The fact is that she was an orphan, and she was being taken care of by her cousin Mordechai. Okay? And you got you as anything that we read about Esther subsequently, you got to understand if the Megillah is setting us up, if the text is setting us up for understanding who Esther is, you got to understand based on what that's doing. It's emphasizing right off the bat something very important about who she is. We identify Esther as somebody who was an orphan and was being taken care of by Mordechai. Okay? So that's that in terms of the first pasuk about Esther. That's the first thing that we need to know. Vayehi. All right. Now, after we've met Mordechai and we've met Esther, pasuk hey and pasuk vav is in meeting Mordechai. Pasuk zayin is meeting Esther. Vayehi pihishamad v'ramelach v'dato. When the decree of the king, all right, the decree that I didn't put in here, but we know the decree of the king going out that all women were going to be rounded up and brought to the king's chambers. Vihishamad v'ramelach v'dato v'kavots uvikavets narot rabot al shushan abira el yad hegai. Right, when it was found out that Esther, that the women were being rounded up to be brought to Hegai, to the king's watcher of his women. So again, this is kind of repetitive language. It was heard that the women were being rounded up, and then Esther was rounded up to Hegai. Okay. Now, until now, what are the only two things that we know? Again, I don't mean to belabor the point. What are the only three things that we know about Esther? She was pretty, she was an orphan, and she was taken care of by Mordechai. Now we learn a fourth thing. Batitav hanarav einav, batisachesed lefanav. Alright? We don't know anything about her character, but it's going to be repeated later. The first thing that we are told about Esther in terms of an active role that she plays in the story is the fact that somebody likes her. First thing, and this is a very important theme, because if we want to take an understanding of Esther's character throughout the story, she is beloved by everybody that crosses her path. All right, there aren't too many people that cross her path, but if we can make a list, maybe at the end we'll actually list them out. Keep this in mind that the first thing that we are told about Esther is not insignificant. The first thing that we know is that this Hegai character really liked her. So as a result of the fact that this guy liked that Hegai liked Esther so much, what did he do? He quickly started giving her all of the beautification treatments, because we've seen, and then we are going to see, all right, with Esther again, that how was the, right, this is the beginning of Perek Bet. How was the system set up? All the women were gathered together, and they would have this really long, extremely long preparatory stage in which they would beautify themselves up. And then once they had that long period of getting themselves set up, then they had their opportunity to get whatever it is that they wanted, and they would have their one night with the king. All right. So they got to choose which music was being played, and they got to choose which perfumes they got to wear. They got to choose, the lighting scheme for the room. All of these things were their choice. So now we are being told that story again within the context of Esther. So Esther was taken; she was beloved, and this guy Hegai immediately started to give her preferential treatment. Pasuk Yud. Lo higida Esther et amav yet maladata ki Mordechai tziva aleha asher lo tagid. Okay, so the first thing that we hear about Esther is that she is well liked, but there's no proactive, right? There's no proactive movement from Esther in that. All we're saying, it's a very passive comment about how she was there and she was well liked. The first thing that we are told about Esther in the story, and I bold this emphatically, the first thing that we are told about Esther in the story is that she's obedient. She's listening to exactly what Mordechai says. Esther did exactly what Mordechai wanted of her. And that is the first Again, so if we're making this list of characters, characteristics of Esther, her parents are dead, she lives with her cousin and being taken care of by him, she's pretty, people like her, or at least Haggai at this stage, Haggai likes her, and she listens to Mordechai, whatever he says. Okay, so now, very quickly, we get into the process of the women. Mordechai, now that we know that Esther is obedient and listening to every word Mordechai says, every single day Mordechai comes along and is checking on her. So you would assume he's giving her orders. Right? What do we know about Esther at this point? We know that Esther does whatever Mordechai's bidding is. So now, the next pasuk makes that much more sense of Mordechai coming along in order to give her marching orders about how to act. This is the pasuk that I was referring to before. This is how it would work for every single woman who was taken in. When it was everybody's turn, she would have 12 months of preparation. Why would they have 12 months spring? That was the amount of time that the treatment was with the smelling, with the that the Yemei Merukei Hen would take. They had a 12-month beautification period. Shishach HaLashim B'Shem HaNamor, 6 months they would take this type of oil, Shishach HaLashim B'Samim, and then they would take 6 months in certain type of smelling, of aromas, U'Batam Rukei HaNashim. And then after this 12-month period, U'Bazeh HaNa'ara Ba'ayel HaMelech, with this preparatory stages, she would come to the king, alright, and whatever she would want, so she would have the 12 months, and then each woman would have the option of getting whatever accoutrement she would desire to go into the king. She would go, and she would spend the night with the king, and then she would come back. So this, then after she spent the night with the king, she was sent to a different group of women who were taken care of by this guy, this different Sarice, this guy Shashgaz, and he would take care of the king concubines. So this was a situation where a woman was basically coming for the rest of her life. Right? You know, when I was taught the story when I was a kid, right, it was the women would be basically come and line up, and Achashverosh would go, "Oh, I like you," and that's when he picked out Esther. So it wasn't like that. The women who actually were going for these tryouts were now became the king's concubines for the rest of their lives, and they were being watched over. And the only way that the woman who was chosen would become the queen would be if Achashverosh picked her and said, "You know, the woman that I got on Tuesday night, that's the one that I want to be the queen." Okay, so. After that introduction of the women, now we get back to Esther. Right, and again we have the repetition of one of the few things that we know about Esther, that she was the cousin of Mordechai, who took her as his daughter. All right, and if you're counting, it's already the third time that that's being explicitly mentioned. When it came time for her to go to the king, lo biksha davar, she didn't request a thing. Okay, it's not that she didn't request the thing. What is it saying? It's not that she didn't want anything. This is also how I always read this pasuk. Lo biksha davar ki im et asher yomar haygeis v'samelach shomer anashim. Did she go in with nothing? What did she go in with? She left it up to this guy Haggai. All right, you can't. I think it's really I know I probably mention this too often, but I'm a psychologist also. I very much appreciate just how Esther is working the psychology of this story. Who is this guy Haggai? Imagine being in his shoes, right? Not a very easy job that he's working with. You have all of these women who are probably hugely anxiety provoked. They have 12 months of preparation for one night at which they have their chance to prove that they should be the person who should be the queen. You can imagine the amount of anxiety that type of, and it's an entire year that this guy's in charge of these women. You can imagine that it was a bit of an oddity feel. And they were probably all extremely opinionated, they were probably extremely distinct about what it is that they wanted and how they wanted the night to go. And you can imagine this guy, this poor Shlemiel, who's stuck dealing with all these opinions. And Esther does the thing that not only is the wisest, but the thing that is most likely to gain her the most favor from this fellow. What does she do? She says, you know the king better than anybody. You're the one who's been doing this for ages. What do I know? I might know what guys from my street or my town like, but I don't know what kind of music the king likes. I don't know what kind of food the king likes. I don't know what kind of lighting system the king likes. I don't know what kind of smells or I don't know what kind of conversation. I don't know if he likes to talk about basketball or baseball or football. I don't know if he likes to talk about, you know, the monetary issues in the empire, if he likes to talk about other women. Maybe he wants to talk about how terrible Vashti was, or maybe he never wants to hear her name mentioned again. You know this stuff, but I don't know it. So why don't you, hey guy, tell me what you think the best course of action is. Now, you can't not love Esther, because she was somebody who already in the first moments is demonstrating that she has like this keen awareness of other people. And she knows how the divine providence had saw fit that Esther was going to be chosen was 100% the case. But I think that a more lofty take on the story is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted it that Esther was chosen because she was fitting for the job. Esther had these innate qualities of the ability to work with people, which made her such a natural leader. And as a result, she was chosen. So from the first moment, again, the first things that we know about her was that she was obedient, yes, but when she was left to her own devices, she was quite clever. Yes, Ellie?
You're giving her all the credit, and which I'm sure she deserves. But you could also look at it that she was she did what she was told to do.
Right. So it could
be have too many opinions.
So it could be, and I'm glad that you mentioned this. So it could be that Esther doing exactly what Haggai said was the orders of Mordechai. And we know that Esther was very close to Mordechai, and Mordechai gave her orders. Now, and it could be 100%, and in which case we basically would be shifting the brains behind this operation to Mordechai instead of Esther. Which we know to some extent she already was. She's already following orders, and she's already making sure to go. Mordechai was already standing in the area. We know that he was giving orders, so it could be. The only thing that I would say, and I'm not saying that you're wrong, because ultimately we don't know, and we can make a plausible case that you're right. The only thing that I would say is that we have examples in the text of Mordechai telling her what to do in situations, and here it doesn't go out of its way to tell us that. Uh-huh. So it could be that Esther was, you know, left to her own devices, did what she thought appropriate. Okay, so lo bishad devar ki imat asher yomar yisgaz yisamel asher manashim, and then shockingly, vatihi Esther no teitchen no seitchen meinei kol roeha. So this is what I mean about her character trait. This is the first character trait that we are told about Esther, is that she, everybody loved her. All right? And notice the context in which this statement is made. All right? And that's why I think it's so significant. That she knew that is the wisest thing for her to do right now is to just tell Haggai, you decide for me what's the best decision, what's the best course of action. And in that, the Megillah describes to us that everybody loved her. Okay? Doesn't tell us that she was wise, right? Think about other characterizations of people in Tanakh. What do we know about Devorah? Devorah HaNeviah. How does the Navi describe her? The first thing that it says about her is she was an Eshet what? Eshet Lapidot. Right? What that means is an interesting question. But the fiery personality that was Devorah, that's not how we're told. That's not how Esther is described. Right? And think about other characters. You know, Moshe was Anav Mikol Adam. Noach was an Ish Tzadik. Tamim Hayab Dorat. An Ish Tzadik and an Ish Tamim. Esther is a Noset Chen Be'inei Kol Roeha. She was somebody. If we're talking about just policy and the makings of a monarchy, I think that the way Esther is described in the text here is somebody that was a natural born monarch, or at least a natural-born leader, because of the fact that she was well-liked. Leadership is dependent on the people who are being led, to some extent at least, being willing to toe the line. And the best way for that to happen is for them to like you. Esther was somebody who was Noset Chen Be'enei Kol Roeha. So the fact that character trait is being mentioned, I think, is very significant. Alright, so not surprisingly, after we know what we know about Esther, so she was taken in and she was beloved by the king more than any of the other women. The first thing that we have is that the way the Megillah is presenting it is that the contest was now over. But we know but we see that is not necessarily 100% the case. Pasuk Yechet, Ayas Amelach Mishteh Gadol Lechol Sarav Yavadav, Eit Mishteh Esther, Vanachal Nidot Asav, Aitein Masayt Kiyad Amelach, who made a big party, Uvikaveit Pesulot Sheinit, Mordechai Yoshem Bishar Amelach. But after the Esther was finally chosen, does Achashverosh's 12-month situation with his betulot stop? No, it does not. He continues. Pasuk Chav, In Esther Magedet Moladatav Yet Amma, Kasher Tziva Aleh Mordechai, Et Ma'amar Mordechai Esther Osa, Kasher Haytav Yom Na'ito. So Esther does what she does. Esther succeeds in gaining the favor of the king and becoming the king's chosen queen. And yet, the way this Perek Bet concludes, it's with Esther following orders 100%. So let's say, so Ellie, we could say that Esther telling Haggai, we'll do whatever it is that you want. We could definitely read it as being just another example of Esther following orders of Mordechai. The other way to read it, at least if it's not obvious, or the way I'd like to suggest we read it based on the subsequent development of the story of Esther's character, the way I'd like to suggest is that this is the one hint that we have, the beginning parts of the story, of Esther asserting her own independence. All right, and it was something small. Think about it. It was something very, very small. She's a part of this huge plan, or at least this huge situation of women being brought into the king's to the king's palace, and Mordechai is giving her orders the entire time. And the first opportunity that she gets to assert a little bit of her own personality into this, she does, and it makes all the difference in the world. She just says the little thing like, "Hey guy, why don't you tell me what's best?" A sentence, but what it means is that by Esther no seitchen b'ni korah, everybody adored her. So in the very beginning stages, we have somebody who's obedient. We know that she is an orphan. We know that she was being taken care of by Mordechai. We know that Mordechai gives her all the orders. But we also know that she has a hint of understanding of how people work, all right? Which is extremely important for the development of the story. And we know that everybody adored her. And you know, I guess the fact that she was that she was a looker didn't hurt matters either. But that's more told said about her in the passive type of way, not in the she went out of her way to be a beautiful woman and used that beauty to assert herself. It's just saying it's part of her character traits that she had nothing to do with. Okay, so the end of the perek is the Bigtan and Teresh conspiring against her, and I would just emphasize here that last bolt that I have is that Esther ended up playing a role in that as well. But in that role, she was doing it was all b'shem Mordechai. So Esther in Perek Bet is, for all intents and purposes, with the exception of that one instance that we were talking about, is the passive character doing the bidding of her cousin, who raised her and who because she spent her entire life following the orders of somebody after the traumatic experience of her parents dying. Okay, so Perek Gimel is the rise of Haman. We didn't mention it, so we don't really need to look at Perek Gimel. Perek Dalet is after Haman has his decree passed by Achashverosh. We have Mordechai's reaction.
The last pasuk Chav Beis, Vayivada Hadavar leMordechai, if you came down to Mordechai about the plot, Vayaged leEsther.
Yeah.
Told Esther. That means what? Face to face.
Yeah.
Which is almost impossible to believe.
Why?
Because there's no way he could have talked to Esther directly at that point. She was in the harem. She was guarded 24/7.
Well,
so unless they had cell phones.
It doesn't say that. No. She was definitely in the Beit HaMelech. But what do you think a queen in the Beit HaMelech did?
But they weren't allowed alone, believe me.
I'm not saying that they were necessarily allowed alone, but we do know about Mordechai that he was in the Persian court. We know how is it
working the king's head? That's what it says. Outside.
Yeah. Well, what does that mean outside? What do we know about the king's inner circle? We know about this from Perek Aleph. I was talking about it a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the Avdei HaMelech that were Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech. Achashverosh was not somebody that used to stroll around Main Street and converse with the people. This was the way a royal court worked. There was an inner circle, and in that inner circle, Mordechai did belong. Why is it that the Megillah, we'll see in a second, makes a big deal about the fact that Mordechai was barred from the court? He wasn't barred from the court because he was the dirty Jew with the yellow star who wasn't allowed in. He was barred from the court because he was dressed inappropriately. The obvious implication of that is that were he not dressed inappropriately, he would have been ushered right in. Mordechai was...
These harems, I've been to Istanbul and I've seen top copy palace. I've seen the harem.
Okay.
Yeah, they were guarded 24/7. No man was allowed inside.
No man. I agree that no. I first of all, the first thing that we need to possibly question is whether the harems of Istanbul are today any different than the harems of Shushan, 2,500 years ago. All right.
And then even the next step, it says, "Vayagel Esther Amalka." So Mordechai told Esther, "Vayagel face to face them." But Tomer Esther Lemelech Bashem Mordechai.
Look at Pasuk Chaf. Et Ma'amar et Mordechai Esther Osa Kasher Haytav Amnaito. All right, Kasher Tzivale Mordechai, Ma'amar Mordechai Esther Osa. They were in contact. If it wasn't face to face, then it was through a messenger.
Now, later on, we see that when Mordechai wanted to tell her about the edict, Mordechai sent a messenger.
Yeah, well, that was because he wasn't allowed into the court.
So how come here he was allowed?
Because he was still dressed well.
Yeah, he was dressed well. The point that I made before is that Mordechai was a court Jew. He was somebody who was actually allowed. He was in the inner circle. He was in there. He had access.
He had access to her here.
He had access. All of the contemporary court Jews who are currently in Washington right now, right?
If he had access to her, then
if Mordechai was here, he would be in APAC right now. He wouldn't be sitting here learning with us.
Court Jew.
Right?
If you have access to her, then you can tell her about Haman's plot.
Yeah.
Well, he only has to send her a messenger because of the. It's clear because of the. He wasn't allowed in because he was dressed inappropriately, right? Mm-hmm. That all right? It would be me going to watch oral arguments in the Supreme Court in shorts and a T-shirt. They wouldn't let me in the door. It doesn't mean that I can't send a message to whoever's in the room.
It also says in the beginning that he was walking back and forth and giving messages to her. And apparently at that time, when she was just starting out, he wasn't able to speak to her directly. But now that she became the queen, she would possibly...
All right, so I think that the text makes it clear that they were in contact. Whether it was in person or whether it was through messenger, through letters, they clearly had in contact with one another. Okay, let's leave it at that. The subject that I want to be emphasizing today is the development of Esther's character. So we opening up, we have Esther is very passive with the one little exception of asking Haggai to make the decision. Possibly, Ellie. Okay, now we have Mordechai. This is Perek Dalet. Mordechai comes along and he is distraught over the news of Haman's edict that the Jewish people are going to be destroyed. Mordechai yadat kol asher na'asah, v'yikre Mordechai et begadav, v'yalbish sak va'efer, v'yalbash sak va'efer. I'm probably going to make that mistake on Purim if I'm laning, so make sure that you catch me. For some reason I say v'yalbash instead of v'yalbash every year. I don't know why. V'yalbash sak va'efer, I just said it now. V'yalbash sak va'efer, my father would know, he corrects me every year, in the earlier years that I was laning. V'yalbash sak va'efer, v'yitzei b'tocha ir, v'yizak sak ha'gadolah amara. So Mordechai finds out about the edict, he sees it posted in shul, and he gives a great cry, and he comes until the gate because he's not allowed to go in dressed inappropriately. All right, pasuk gimel. I skip. Vatavona the pasuk dal. Vatavona na'arot Esther v'sarisei v'agidulah v'telchal makam od. All right, so the Esther's servants come along and say, "You're never going to believe what Mordechai is wearing." Why are they? By the way, why are they reporting to Esther about Mordechai's state? Why does that make sense? Right, exactly. Whether people, Esther Moladatai. Esther didn't tell her about her lineage. She didn't tell about the fact that she was a Jewess. But it was abundantly clear from this text that people knew that Esther and Mordechai were buddies. Right? They were seen talking. Otherwise, why does it make sense that all of these people who had no idea that Esther and Mordechai were related are coming along and reporting to them how Mordechai was poorly dressed outside of the palace of the king? It doesn't make any sense. Unless you say that everybody knew that Esther and Mordechai used to talk a lot. Okay. But the cry Esther, so what happens? Vatishlach begadim lahalbishet Mordechai ulahasir sakom mi'alav velo kibel. So Esther, in one of the first few things of activity that we are shown in the Megillah, tries to send clothing to Mordechai to, you know, basically allow him to clean himself up a little bit. V'lo kibel, and he refuses her. So the first act, one of the first acts that we've seen, proactive movements in the Megillah from Esther is rejected. But the cry Esther Lata. All right, so now we have the whole back and forth between Esther and Mordechai, and this is when Esther's character really does shift. But the cry Esther Lata. Esther called the servant and wanted to send a messenger to Mordechai. I want to hear what's going on. All right. Apparently, the fact that Mordechai refused the clothing that she had sent made a real impression. Right? She didn't notice when they heard that Mordechai was being that when Mordechai was dressed inappropriately, was wearing his sackcloth and the entrance to the palace, did she immediately send a messenger to find out what was going on? No. The first thing that she did was, you can't look like such a chutzpinyak, I guess, was the problem in the term that she used. Alright, you can't look so disheveled, so go get dressed and let's talk. And then no, he refused. So then the next thing that she did was, okay, now I gotta figure out what's going on. Vayeged lo l'Mordechai et kol asher karau, vayetzei atach l'Mordechai, so our pasuk vav, He tells her the whole story about Haman and the money and how everything terrible is going to happen and the notice that went up about it. So she tells Hatach, look at this Pashkevil, right? Look at this notice that went up in Shul that everybody's going to get destroyed. I need you to go to the king. All right, stop whatever it is that you're doing. Go to the king right now and get this taken care of. All right? That's Letzavot Aleh. All right, that's the circumstance that I'm emphasizing. That he commanded her, Letzavot Aleh, actually, literally commanded her, to beseech the king to ask for the well-being of the nation. And Hatach brings this message. Now, keep in mind, this is somebody who until this point has been nothing but obedient. Always following Mordechai. She was, what's the first thing that we're told about her? And we're told about it repeatedly. Her parents are dead and Mordechai is taking care of her. She follows Mordechai. Kol Esther Amar, whatever the, what was the pasuk, right? That Amar Mordechai Esther Osa Kashari Tavi Abnaito. That was that was their relationship. But Esther doesn't immediately capitulate. She responds. Every single person knows that anybody who goes before the king when they are not summoned, they're going to get killed immediately. Levad, the only exception, the only way that a person, that meaning, the rule is, it's not that there's a possibility that I will be killed. It's not that it's a 50% chance. Everybody who goes before the king, when they're not summoned, gets killed. The only sliver of possibility that it's not going to happen is if he lifts his scepter. Right? And if he does that, then there's a possibility that I'll live. But basically what she's saying here is that there's absolutely no way for me to do what you're asking. Okay? So, right? I have not been summoned for another 30 days. Alright, so we're getting more of a hint here of who Esther was, what her relationship was with the king. This is not the type of queen who, they didn't have breakfast together every single morning, they didn't sleep together every single night. She only had access to him on very rare occasions. So the fact that she was a queen, right, this is another misconception of, you know, with the way I used to learn this Megillah when I was a kid. It is abundantly clear that Esther and Achashverosh had very little to do with each other. Otherwise, why is this whole, you know, this whole drama of her going to beseech the king such a big deal? If she saw him at breakfast, then why would it be a big deal to go and ask her in the afternoon when he was holding court to save the Jewish people? She never saw him, right? So the position of queen in Persia clearly was a position of stature, but a very little influence.
Yeah, but she was able to tell him about the plot with the other two guys.
You're right. And the pasuk doesn't, the text doesn't give us any significant. So it's possible that was an instance in which she ran into the room and said, King, you know, Achashverosh, your life is being threatened, in which case he obviously lifted up his scepter. But this was that was an instance in which his life was dependent. Here Esther is going, and it's a really excellent point to compare those two. Here is an instance in where Esther was going where it was her own life. And while the king might have been willing to stop everything, especially considering what we know about him, this is what we were talking about last time, about how Achashverosh seems to be, through the story, a paranoid character who was worried about his own hold on his monarchy, Esther here was not doing anything about it.
From the previous king,
all right, so that we mentioned that last time also. This is Chazal talk about how...
About his position.
Yeah, that he was dependent on his wife for his position. Possible. Okay. So that's the anxiety that's being mentioned here. My own word, the Chaylash. So Esther says, I'm not due there for another 30 days. I give the word the Chayat Yibrei Esther. Now Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayomer Mordechai, now if you see the pay there, there's a psik in the text. So again, this is always just something, whenever you're trying to read it, if you open up a Megillah, that means that there's a space. It's just a little bit of a shift. It's usually, you'd refer to it as a different parshia. It's a different subject. The fact that we're shifting here is a good indication that there's some shift in what's going on. And this is in the middle of a conversation that pay is there. So the fact that we're going to see a shift here thematically actually does make sense, even though we're in the middle of a conversation. Mordechai says to Esther, excuse me. Don't think for one minute and this is a little bit of a nasty response. You know, the way I always read it. It's a little bit of a harsh response to Esther's comment. Esther makes a perfectly logical argument to Mordechai. No, Mordechai says, look, there's something really bad going on with Haman. You got to go deal with it right now. And Esther responds, me going to deal with it is going to do absolutely nothing. Zilch. I'm going to go in. He's going to put me to death. And then the Jewish people are going to still be put to death. And now, whatever influence I technically, possibly, theoretically could have is going to be completely gone. All right? And Mordechai's response is not, you know, it is basically assuming that the only thing that you care about is yourself and you don't really care about the Jewish people. That's basically how Mordechai, at least that seems to be how he's responding. You think that the fact that you're queen means that you're going to be spared from this edict? You're wrong. What's going to happen? You won't speak up at this very important time. We're going to get saved by somebody else. Right? And you and the house of your father is going to be lost. For another time, but we need to understand this statement, considering the fact that she was an orphan. Right? I'm not sure exactly what it means, but it definitely means something. That he's invoking that Mordechai, who raised her, again, emphasizing so many times the fact that she was without parents. The first thing that we are told about her is, and it's mentioned twice, it's inescapable the fact that Mordechai is using that language to try and rouse her to action. At uveit avich tovedu. Umiyodayim la'it kazot higat l'malchut. Maybe it was for this very purpose that you were brought into the kingship. Okay? So, Atomer Esther. So now let's look at pasuk 10. We're on page 3 at the top in the bold. Atomer Esther la'ashim al Mordechai. Leif knoset kol ayudim v'nimtzim mishushan v'tzum olay v'atapuvi al tishul shlot shadamim lay l'vayom. Gam ani v'naratay atzum kein. U'vachin avu al amelach asher lo chadat v'chasher alti avalti. Okay, Mordechai, you win. I'm going to do it, but here's what you're going to do for me. You're going to gather everybody together and you're going to fast on my behalf. And everybody's going to fast. And on the third day of fasting, I'm going to go into the king. And when I go into the king, that's when if I perish, then I perish. And how does the parak end? The parak ends not with Esther doing Mordechai's bidding, but Asher Tzivita Alav Esther. All right. The parak ends with Esther actually giving the bidding to Mordechai. Now it's interesting, you know, a lot of the times where I've heard people read through this parak as being the shift, which it unquestionably is, of the character of Esther from being the passive one following orders to the one giving the orders, it ignores the fact that in the end Esther is doing exactly what Mordechai wanted, right? Mordechai says, you gotta go into the king and you gotta make things happen. And in the end, that's exactly what Esther does. She just gives her own caveat. It's not that Esther says, no, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to take an ad out in the New York Times. I know that that Achashverosh reads the times, so he'll definitely see it, and then he's going to obviously call me in, and then he's going to want to know what's going on. Or it's not that I'm going to start making trouble with the, or I'm going to mention Bigtan and Teresh, or I'm going to, I don't know. She, in the end, the plan that Esther follows is exactly what Mordechai wants of her, only he gives a caveat. So Esther is not 100% in the driver's seat at the end here, because Mordechai, she's still doing what Mordechai wants, but she's doing what Mordechai wants, and in the process, Mordechai is also doing what she wants. So I don't think that it's the shift here in Perek Dalet. I don't think it's the shift of Esther being the dominant force. I think it's Esther and Mordechai, to some extent, becoming on equal planes. And I think that that actually does shift, but this isn't the spot where it shifts. Okay, let's rush through, all right? Because that was really, I think Perek Dalet was the thing that I wanted to spend most time on. So the next little bit is how they're going to execute the plan. So Esther goes through this whole spiel, in which I think, right, and taking what we know about Esther so far, she's basically doing what she does best. She's taking the fact that she's extremely likable, that she knows how people work and she knows how people tick. She knows what people are, what it is about certain people that drives them, and she uses that to exploit the whatever it is that she needs in that moment. Now, what we know about Achashverosh from Perek Aleph and how the text introduces us to him, and this is what we spoke about two weeks ago, is the fact that he has this nervous grasp on his monarchy. And as a result, she knows that the things that are going to get him to be most agity are when he thinks that there's some chicanery at play. There's some intrigue going on in the court. So that's how that's how Esther plays it. She also knows that she is a likable person that people just generally gravitate towards. So that's when Esther first goes in Parakeh, that's how we're first introduced to it. Look at Pasuk Bet with the bold and source 5. Vayikirot ha-melechat Esther ha-malka ometet b'chatzer nasa'ah chen be'inav. Right? This is not the first time that we have this language of Esther just being liked by the people that look at her. Now, Mordechai's orders, and this is why this is so important, Mordechai's orders were to go before the king and beseech on behalf of the people that this edict be reversed and us not be killed. That's not what she does. Right? And this is where I think, not in Perek Dalet, but in Perek He, where Esther's assertiveness and Esther's complete shift finally takes shape. Because this is where Esther completely veers from Mordechai's plan. And she starts her own plan. And she starts using this, not only this the fact that she was Noseit Chen Be'enei Kol Ro'eha, but she starts using her knowledge of other people and what makes them nervous in order to actualize the plan that she sees is the best option for saving the Jewish people. To do so, what does she do? She says, she doesn't say we all know, she doesn't say save the people, she says, I want you and Haman to come to a gathering of mine. All right, now think of Mordechai in the mind of, I think of Achashverosh in his own mind. This is not a wife that he knows very well. He clearly doesn't know her very well. All he knows is that she's a very likable person, and they don't see each other very often. And the first thing that she has, their request is, why don't you spend more time with me, Achashverosh, sweetie? Why don't we could spend the night together tonight? The first thing that she says is, I want you and Haman to come along. Okay? Now, Esther is the queen, and the first thing that is requested of her is that Achashverosh be asking that Achashverosh and somebody else join. You got to imagine that there's something going on in his mind. You got to imagine that he's walking away wondering, what is it that Esther is interested in Haman about? I don't get it. At the same time, you would imagine that Haman, and this we don't need to guess, the text actually tells us explicitly, that Haman was extremely excited about the fact that the queen was noticing him. He thought Haman, who was clearly a very ambitious person, cared a lot about his own future, was noticing that people were taking note of his skills and talents. So then they come back, they come to this party, and then what happens? And they ask them to come to another party. And then basically all she's doing is further emphasizing, further playing on those very character traits. Achashverosh only has to be wondering more why Esther is again asking me and Haman to come. And Haman is only going to have this ego fed that much more. And then we have this, Perek Vav. Perek Vav is Balayla Hu Nadadashna Tamelach. The king can't sleep. Haman comes along. And now, without Esther's prodding of his ego, you got to wonder whether or not that story would ever take place. Now, did Esther have that in mind? I think if we take it from the perspective that she was a Nevi'ah, that she was acting on behalf of Hashkacha, so yes, I think that it definitely was part of the plan. The text doesn't mention it, but I think that even without the story, the fact that Haman had an extremely inflated ego coming into this story was extremely significant to how the story develops.
Does Haman know at this point that Esther is Jewish?
No, nobody does. Ein Esther Magedet Lo Natavia Tamar. Nobody knew who she was. Not Achashverosh, not anybody. The only person that knew was Mordechai. Okay, so then we get to Perek Zion, and that's when finally Esther lets all of this unfold. And that's when, that's when, in the context of all of this, is that anybody's? Oh, okay, sorry about that. It's fine. So that's when, in the context of all of this, Esther finally lets loose the information. Vatan Esther Amalka, we're in the bold in source number 6. Vatan Esther Amalka Vatomar, imatzati chem einecha melech, v'imal melech tov, tinatin li nafshi b'she'ilati v'ami b'vakashati. After Achashverosh is laboring, trying to figure out what Esther wants, he finally says, please help me out, because my entire nation is at stake here. Fascinating pasuk. We can have to deal with it another time. That my entire nation is being threatened right now, and I need somebody to help me out. And Achashverosh says, he's bubbling right now. This Esther, who's no seit chen meine kol roeha, I'm trying to, you know, not only maintain my monarchy, maintain my hold on power, but keep my wife happy. And I have this guy Haman, who my wife is chasing, and now she's telling me that somebody's after her. He knew exactly where she was going. Who is this person? And Esther says, "Ish tsar v'oyev Haman harazeh, an evil, evil, evil man." Right now, Achashverosh, who's got all of this, bubbling anger, fear, and frustration about the possibility of somebody usurping him, suddenly is being told that his second in command is the guy that is messing around. And what happens? He blows a gasket. He gets furious. So Esther set this all up, not only to tell Achashverosh what the situation was, but to tell him within the context of playing on his very fears, playing on his very anxieties. And then the rest of the subsequent part of the story is just almost hysterical. Achashverosh needs to go calm down because he's so furious, and he leaves, and then he comes back. And then, I always picture this is that, you know how, it's like the guy who's playing a prank, like sticks his foot out and somebody, trips over it? You know, Esther kind of like had this set up that as soon as Achashverosh came back, it just happened to be, Haman nafal al mita asher Esther alea. That Haman happened to have fallen down on the bed that Esther was there. And you can imagine when the king was bubbling to such an extent, worried about the future of his monarchy, worried about his hold on power, thinking that he's being conspired against by his very servants. That's the moment that Haman happens to fall on his wife's bed, right? So that's why I always pictured Esther having paying somebody to trip up Haman at that very moment. And as a result, so the king's just like, he's like, ah, what am I supposed to do? And that's when he says, off with his head. All right? So Esther set up beautifully all of these pieces of the puzzle, all of these pieces of the chessboard, so that at that critical moment, there was the one thing that Achashverosh had to do above all else was to end it by ending Haman. And it's clear that the way that they thought the best way of moving forward was to get Haman out of the picture. That sets up now, once Haman is gone, it sets up the next Perechet. Perechet is when Haman is when Esther goes and besieges before the king one more time, that the edict is still there even though Haman is gone. So what are we supposed to do? And that's when, with Haman out of the picture, and Haman finally no longer is whispering into the king's ear about how the Jewish people were mefuzarim farad beino amim, they were these nasty conspiratorial people who were a poison to the empire. When Haman was no longer was finally out of the picture because Esther saw to it, that's when Achashverosh was able to basically get good advice about the Jewish people and allow them to defend themselves. And that was really the end of the story. Yeah.
The king plays dumb, as if he didn't know anything about the plot. Am I correct?
Why? What do you...
Because he says, who is the person? Where is he? Who would dare say such a thing?
Right, so you have to say, how did he not know that
he,
there...
He knew. Haman told
well,
him.
Well, I would say a couple of things. I would say a couple of things. How much Achashverosh knew about who this nation was is subject to question. How does Haman present it? There was this strange nation that's a poison to the empire, and you need to destroy them. He gives him his signet ring and he says, you do whatever it is that you want.
Oh, I see.
So I don't, look, I think it's hard to imagine that if these flyers went out all over the kingdom, that Achashverosh didn't get wind of one of them, but it's possible he didn't care, right? There was, you think about it, the sheer, if you look at the size of the Persian Empire, think about the sheer number of people that Achashverosh was in charge of. Maybe he just didn't care, right? There was this one small little subgroup of people that Haman had it in for. Fine. Mm-hmm. Let him do his thing. I would just emphasize, just in closing, the fact that Esther ends up being the central figure of this story, the fact that that Pasuk Tet, that Perek Tet, when it's recapping, it tells us the story from the perspective of Uvoa Lifnei HaMelech, right? That at the time that she came before, one of the only things about the story that were being told, the fact that Chazal choose to tell the story of Esther being the one making the request for Chag Purim and for Megillat Esther to be observed and included in Tanakh, makes so much sense once you understand Esther's character. She starts off as the very passive person, but with an innate ability to understand people and to have people like her. In the end, that's something that she very much uses to her advantage. And as the story develops, Haman and Achashverosh each have their own proclivities, their own buttons that she knows how to push and manipulate exactly to her, to her needs. And in the end, she gets what she needs. She gets what the Jewish people ultimately need because of that ability. So I think that Esther is really one of the most fascinating characters in Tanakh because of the fact that she has this shift. When we have somebody like Gidon, when we have somebody like Avraham Avinu, when we have somebody like Moshe, well, Moshe's not actually not a good example because there's a shift with him also. But when we have so many examples of characters in Tanakh who have dominant traits and use those traits throughout the story in order to enact whatever it is that needs to get done, and those instances are all magnificent in terms of understanding those characters. Esther is somebody who we are shown has an innate ability. It's very much dormant, and then as the story develops, she develops that ability, and she ends up using it to become the dominant figure that she is. So I think that when we're reading through Megillat Esther, we really can take an appreciation of these characters and seeing how the shift happens throughout the entire thing. With that, I wish everybody a wonderful day and a Chag Purim Sameach.